Welcome to Not Artificially Sweetened, a weekly podcast where we reflect on all things diabetes. Your hosts are specialist physician Stan Landau and diabetes specialist nurse Michael Brown. We are passionate about using our talents to change lives for the better. Our mission is to build bridges of insight and understanding between people with diabetes and the health professionals that facilitate their care. Nothing is off the table here as we discuss real people, their real issues and stories, and together discover real answers to many vexing practical issues in diabetes and its management. Welcome back to Not Artificially Sweetened. This is episode number 40, and we now have listeners in a total of 29 countries, as far afield as the United Kingdom, United States, Saudi Arabia, Zimbabwe, New Zealand, Cyprus, and the Maldives. We really appreciate your listenership, and we hope that we're bringing you valuable content that will either change your practice in diabetes or your lived experience of the condition. With me as usual in studio, I have Dr. Stan Landau.
Hello, Michael, and hello, listeners.
Great to be back after a wonderful episode last week, Stan. A lot of learnings there. And we've got a great episode today focusing more on technology in diabetes, a very underappreciated and for many out of reach help to manage diabetes. In the meantime, I think you've got some thoughts on some urological symptoms in diabetes, Stan.
Now, all too often in the clinic, people with diabetes will come in and report problems with passing urine, sometimes too much, sometimes too little. And one must be very careful when listening to a person with diabetes give their history, because one gets the impression that everything that is mentioned is specifically associated with diabetes. And if you look at some of the so-called giants of geriatric medicine or care of the elderly, one of the major symptoms that goes hand in hand with pain can often be bladder problems, either with controlling your bladder or perhaps not being able to pass sufficient urine. And I just want to separate a couple of things here, because for men and women, those symptoms may show up differently. For men, for example, a common condition of urological symptoms is benign enlargement of the prostate gland, and that can show up with urination at night, an incomplete stream, feeling as if your bladder hasn't completely emptied. And very often, people will attribute that to the quality of their diabetes management. And you sit down with them and you download their blood glucose data, and you see that perhaps the management is in fact optimal. And it's at that point in time to recognize that here is a person who's in need of onward referral, perhaps to a urologist. Similarly, with women who may complain of symptoms that we refer to as an overactive bladder, almost an itchy bladder, a bladder that goes every 5-10 minutes, that you're looking for the toilets around your shopping center. You know, Michael, there's a word for that. It's called toilet mapping. Mm-hmm. You know, how many people, if you just ask them where they park their car, do they eye out the toilet facilities at their shopping malls? And it's an important clue, because people say, we've always parked, you know, on the upper level. Well, that's already telling you that they're very mindful of their urological symptoms. My recommendation for healthcare workers involved in the management of diabetes is listen carefully to that, because there's a lot more telling us beyond diabetes. And in fact, unless your diabetes management is poor and your blood glucose levels are perhaps well above 15 millimoles, you probably have urological symptoms that are unrelated to elevations in blood glucose.
Absolutely. I think that's something that a lot of people miss. For me, what is the distinguishing factor about urinary frequency and insufficient diabetes management is that the urinary frequency is paired with large volumes of urine. A lot of the other urological symptoms generally pass small amounts of urine. And that, for me, is quite an important differentiator. What do you think, Stan?
I think that's spot on. We also see chronic constipation as a source of urological symptoms. So, you know, thinking further afield, it isn't always the diabetes. And people with diabetes, you may often sometimes be surprised that the healthcare practitioner you're seeing on that day expands the thinking that there are other members of the team. And we haven't specifically had a urologist on, but you know, Michael, thinking about it now, that's probably something that's very relevant. And we think of the link sometimes between diabetes and prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. We've always spoken so much about screening for medical conditions, whether it be dental health, the colon cancer, breast screening. I would add in that prostate cancer screening forms part of that broader clinical assessment that we undertake. So as simple as the urological symptoms sound, I think that goes back to good medical training, where we are taught to take a good history from a person sitting in front of you. We undertake a clinical examination. We rely on a battery of blood tests or other to assist us, whether it be an x-ray or not. But the field of diabetes is quite unique, because we rely quite heavily on technology in terms of diabetes. And it's the deliberate looking at technology today that coincidentally led me to a colleague that we had actually dealt with many, many years back. And we'll get into that later, Michael. But Dr. David Kerr joins us today. It is when this program is broadcast, in fact, Thanksgiving in the USA. Mm. And what's interesting about Dr. Kerr is he is, in fact, originally from Scotland, referred to as the Scotsman in the Golden State, and he's joining us from the west coast of the USA. So, David, thank you for joining our podcast.
Thank you very much for the kind invitation. It's a real pleasure to join you today. I say it's Thanksgiving, but it's just early in California, so we've got a whole day of celebration and turkey eating and American football to come.
Lovely to hear your Scots brogue again.
Yeah, it's quite an advantage having a Scots brogue in California. Many, many Americans, certainly on the West Coast, claim to have European heritage. And most of the time, it's either Scottish or Irish.
Okay.
I've yet to meet an American who claims English heritage.
Oh, sure.
David, you were in South Africa perhaps 20 years ago at the onset of the insulin pump kind of revolution that was manifesting. I remember Larry Distiller talking about insulin pumps that could be worn on your back in the earliest of early days. But from around 2004, 2005 in this country in South Africa, Roche launched their insulin combo pump at that point in time. And a large number of South African specialists and endocrinologists, diabetes nurse specialists got together. And that's where we were introduced to you. In those days, you were still a consultant endocrinologist in Bournemouth in the UK. We're interested, as are our listeners, in understanding how you made the leap across the pond and why technology is so central to the kind of work you have done and continue to do in diabetes.
Well, thanks for it. It's actually, like many things in life, very serendipitous. So I was in Bournemouth and I ran a very large hospital department. It was in internal medicine and diabetes, not a teaching hospital, but a massive place in Bournemouth, as you say. And we had, 20,000 people with diabetes registered. And we did a lot of community work there, launching education programs. But also from the beginning, we were very interested in the application of technology. In those days, as you say, it was insulin pump therapy to begin with. And we ended up having one of the largest pump centers in the country. And following that, we started work doing clinical trials with continuous glucose monitors. And I've been around long enough to remember that we were part of the first randomized controlled clinical trial of a real-time sensor. It's called the Guardian Control Trial. It was a very important trial, but it was one of those that wasn't as perhaps organized as we would do nowadays. We were so excited about having a technology where people could access their glucose levels every few minutes. And so the trial consisted of giving it to people with type 1 diabetes and saying, what do you think? And they were randomized to wearing it all the time, some wearing it less often than a control group. And the results were spectacular. I mean, the improvements were off the charts in terms of glucose. But from my perspective, more importantly, the improvement in quality of life for people and the ability to experiment. It actually turns out the very first person with diabetes in Europe to wear a real-time CGM, as we call them, was a patient in Bournemouth. And so I gave this person the sensor and said, right, what are you going to do with it? He said, doctor, I'm going down the pub. Mm. I've always wondered what 2 pints of Stella Artois would do to my glucose levels. So we became more and more interested, and there were a lot of spin-off benefits. One was that other members of the diabetes team, because we're very team-oriented, could get involved in this so that the dietitians could start insulin pump therapy. The podiatrists would be measuring blood pressures. And we applied this multidisciplinary approach, and we ended up, I say, with a very large clinical service. We were doing clinical trials. And then around 2010, gosh, it's going back, I got asked if I would take some time off and move to the San Francisco Bay Area to be editor of the Journal of Diabetes Science and Technology. And that's when I met David Klonoff, and we've been friends and collaborators ever since. So I spent a year and a bit there, went back to Bournemouth, and everything was chugging along, as we say. And then I got asked if I'd be interested in taking up a new position in Santa Barbara, California, as director of research at Sanson Diabetes Research Institute. And that was in 2014. And so we decided life's too short. Why not try this? We've never been to Santa Barbara, but it turns out this is heaven on earth here.
Oh, wonderful. What I loved was your referral with CGM, the ability for people to experiment with what happens. And I think that's a great learning to just put out to our audience.
Yeah.
The diabetes isn't just about following road schedules, but it's actually about doing the personal experiment for you. and seeing what works for you and what happens for you in certain environments or with certain foodstuffs. Maybe just expand on that a bit.
Yeah, so most of the work until recently has been in people living with type 1 diabetes. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's really important because the evidence is now overwhelming of the value of CGM if you can afford it and get your hands on it,
right,
which is not a small undertaking in many parts of the world, sadly. And now that's developed into closed-loop insulin delivery systems, which are revolutionizing type 1 diabetes management and moving across into other areas. But when I arrived here in Santa Barbara, where everyone thinks it's full of Hollywood A-listers, and it is, and expatriate royals, there are some here, it's also noteworthy that 50% of the local population are Hispanic Latino.
Mm.
And as a Scotsman arriving in the Golden State, I started to look into this, and it turns out that Hispanic Latinos here have double the rate of diabetes, mm-hmm. they have more complications, higher A1C, and usually they get it at a younger age
right.
than white counterparts. And so we decided to embark on a series of programs. First of all, making sure that we could give people from these communities technology, including CGM. And this whole idea of democratizing access to technology has really taken off. We ended up doing a number of studies. I've actually changed jobs. I'm now with a big hospital conglomerate called Sutter Health. I'm a senior investigator in diabetes research and digital health equity from Northern California to Los Angeles. And the momentum of using technology for populations who are traditionally excluded is really catching fire over here. And it makes sense because we started giving CGMs to people who were not on insulin with type 2 diabetes.
Mm.
We gave CGMs to people with pre-diabetes and people at risk of diabetes. And when you do that, you start to see changes in glucose profiles where you can tease out that things aren't quite normal in certain people. And then that raises the potential of applying interventions, lifestyle interventions, more effectively and much earlier. And I'm actually trying to kickstart a program in Johannesburg with colleagues there where we would like to use CGM again in people with pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes and see if it gives enough information that people can make meaningful changes to their approach to food choices, physical activity, life. There's a big learning, though, that we still need to do, and it is that in type 1 diabetes, we assume that if you give people their real-time data, they understand and know what to do with it, and that actually proved to be the case more often than not. I'm not so sure in type 2 diabetes and pre-diabetes. We need to do a lot more work about what happens when you give people their physiological data, their glucose data, their blood pressure data. Do they understand, first of all? That's a fair question. But then the more important question is, are they in a position where they can do something about it? Now, I presume in South Africa, and it's the same in many other countries, that the social factors that influence our day-to-day choices are sometimes overwhelming for people with diabetes.
Mm.
And you may have access to CGM and everything, but life gets in the way.
Right.
And it's actually very hard to make those changes. And that's an area of research and innovation that we're very interested in exploring. And as a consequence, we've been trialing things such as food as medicine, prescribing food to people.
I like that idea that life gets in the way, because so often you can have wonderful diabetes management profiles. This week, person had their kitchen renovated. They're eating out 3 days a week. They're eating at the neighbors. The kids have nowhere to eat. They're eating outside.
Yeah.
Just renovating your kitchen. Diabetes management just went for a loop. That resonates very well with me. David, when we spoke about introducing insulin pumps in South Africa a good 20 years ago, it's not dissimilar to, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong here, because that was the time when the early inhaled insulins were beginning to make some noise, a product called Exubra. And if I understood correctly, and it never came to South Africa, the market rejected it because in those days, people with diabetes weren't consulted enough. And it was misunderstood that they, in fact, were looking for technology that would be better than pricking their finger, than the convenience of taking an inhaled insulin. Is that right? Was that the earliest sense of patient advocacy behind we actually want something that the manufacturers are telling us is not what we want?
This is a perennial problem, particularly in technology. We have lots of hipsters here on the West Coast who will build new and exciting shiny things with the expectation that people with diabetes will be, you know, breaking the door down to access them. No, that's not what happens. Diabetes, by and large, is a chronic, incurable, miserable condition which interferes dramatically with day-to-day life. And most importantly, the future is completely uncertain. There's a potential for horrible outcomes. And so what people with diabetes want is things that, one, they can access and can afford, two, that are not burdensome. And that's a real problem with a lot of what's been created, building technologies that are not very helpful. For example, do I really want a smartphone app that tells me I've had a bad night's sleep? Because I can tell you I've had a bad night's sleep. I want the app to do something about it. Mm. And there's another thing that in the US is a big problem, is that you have populations with a disproportionate burden of diabetes. These are the same populations who may not be connected to the internet.
Right.
They may not have access to a reliable plan for the data and so on and so forth. So whilst we all get really excited about new and wonderful digital health technologies, there's still the basics here. And you're absolutely right, Stan. It's so important that we involve people with diabetes at the beginning of the development of the technology process. And that's something we want to take on board. Here's a great example. I recently went online and went to the companies that make continuous glucose monitors. And every company has got, you know, for information, there's a question that says, what is continuous glucose monitoring? And then there's two or three paragraphs of text. So I copied and pasted that text and put it through what's called a readability engine. It assesses the level of reading and understanding you need to have to make sense of the information. The readability level was grade 11 in the United States. The average American reads at grade 8 to 9. Mm-hmm. So there's a great example of the industry of the diabetes community putting a barrier in place, which does not need to be there. And then when you get into digital literacy, what does the user interface look like? Is it full of algorithms and questions and graphs and things? Because many people see that they can be potentially overwhelmed. So having people in diabetes in at the beginning and testing the UI and the UX, to use the jargon, makes so much sense to me. And I think we should be doing more of that. And also be careful that we don't include the usual suspects, the terms of the influence of people who are loud and vociferous on social media, that we engage with the communities who really are impacted by diabetes in the development of digital health technologies.
We see a lot of people in our clinic who use non-proprietary software to aid in their continuous glucose monitoring or in their pump.
Hacking the pumps.
And there's tons of stuff coming out how safe these are. And in fact, the numbers are greater than those who've ever been studied in clinical trials. Are you in support of open source tech done by the person with diabetes for people with diabetes?
Why not? Why not?
Yeah.
The industry and the diabetes community have not engaged as much as they could and should have done over recent years. Mm. So it's not surprising that the DIY diabetes community have stepped up and said, it doesn't have to be like this. And I think this is actually welcome, in my humble opinion. And over time, we're seeing the safety and everything, but there's still a lot more to do. Most of the DIY activities have taken place with type 1 diabetes, quite understandably. So what about DIY in the type 2 space? What about looking at new technologies that can help with, for example, food choices? And let me just develop that a little bit. I've got a kind of unusual connection. I'm also, or have an academic post at Rice University in Houston. So I hang out with a bunch of really smart engineers. And it's actually quite good for a medic to hang out with engineers. It just opens all sorts of interesting doors. But with the folks at Rice, we did this very simple project where we asked mostly Hispanic Latino, but you could do this in any community, anywhere in the world. And we looked at them. Are they at risk of diabetes? Do they have pre-diabetes? Do they have type 2 diabetes? And we prescribed vegetables. The program was called Farming for Life. So we didn't give them nutrition education. We simply prescribed, and I made up this prescription, you know, I signed David Kerr, MD, and They would be given 21 servings of locally sourced, seasonally available, fresh vegetables every week. And this went on for 3 months. There's about 300 plus people in this. And as I say, we didn't tell them that this is an eggplant or a carrot or an apple, you know, didn't tell them anything about that. But we just improved access. And what happened was that we followed them up, gave them CGMs and various other things, but simply we measured the things you'd expect us to measure. We measured the blood pressure, we measured the waist circumference, we measured the weight, and all of these improved. And the blood pressure quite dramatically. And for those who had type 2 diabetes, there was a decent fall in the HbA1c of around 0.4%, which is what you get in a pharmaceutical clinical trial.
Sure.
Although we didn't plan it too much up front, we also asked people to self-report what they thought about their sleep and their mood and their self-perception of pain. And what happened was that over time, there were dramatic improvements in sleep, mood, and a reduction in pain score. We also used some questionnaires, which have been shown to be valid, to measure depression, anxiety, and stress. They all improved significantly, dramatically. We also find a reduction in food insecurity, which actually is a big driver of misery in diabetes and other chronic diseases. So we're keen to explore this going forward, and we're planning to do some other work where we'll find people with diabetes who might be struggling to achieve the A1C that they desire. It might be higher than they want. And we're going to, this is in type 2, we're going to be offering them CGM and the food prescriptions. And we're also going to be working with some behavior experts to look at the language that we use when you're helping people make choices about A or B. It's really important that we think about the words that are used, first of all, to make sure they're understood, but also that they're culturally relevant and also that they're meaningful for that person. So there's a lot of work still to be done, but I think it's unusual to do this because most doctors who are researchers involved in clinical trials of pharmaceutical agents, I mean, that's the bottom line. I think there's a whole opportunity to do much more looking at lifestyle choices, the impact of the social determinants that affect these choices, and the application of technology to support choices that are going to have better outcomes for people with diabetes.
I think it's a wonderful thing to hear from someone who's so invested in technology, who's pairing their love for and work in technology with a really basic nutritional intervention.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing which is going to happen is that the diabetes education that's currently on offer, we're going to have to take a hard look at that. You might think this is heresy, but I'm quoting some other people as well. I'm not alone in this. Diabetes education works in clinical trials. It's fantastic. The problem is that very few people are referred. Of those who are referred, few turn up.
Right.
And of those who turn up once, they don't come back. Now, that is not anyone's fault. It's certainly not the fault of anyone with diabetes. It just says to me that maybe the way we are delivering or engaging, partnering with people with diabetes needs a fresh look. Because we know that diabetes education, when it is delivered and understood and becomes actionable, there are measurable benefits. Making that happen in the real world is going to require a lot of new ways of thinking.
Right.
And that's where technology can help. I mean, we are used to using our phones to book a flight, order a pizza, check your bank account, and we understand how to do that most of the time. But in healthcare, we haven't really tried to look at what's on offer from the consumer perspective and to make sure that one, it is acceptable, two, that it's engaged with, and three, that it's sticky when it comes to apps and other forms of digital health. So again, that's another area of huge interest for everyone.
David, I have the feeling that most of diabetes medicine for the last 20, 30 years has predominantly been determined by the pharma industry themselves. We're in this avalanche of GLP at the moment, which is this perception of a holy grail outcomes, dire shortages for those who've really done well in it, and lots for the middle group. I like the idea that we've almost put the cart before the horse here, because the novel approach to technology is going to give us insights that may not necessarily need a prescriptive medication in order to intervene, which ultimately will be beneficial from a cost point of view and less exposure to treatments, but changes the narrative of diabetes that it doesn't have to be the sequential drug adding on that we were told from these old studies. And for our audience, these original studies that started in the late 1970s in the UK kind of said to us, one pill, two pills, insulin, and that's it.
Yes.
I'm really impressed that you've opened our eyes and hopefully our audience's eyes in terms of making the technology work better for what the person with diabetes wants.
The key word is person here. Where this is all going, and artificial intelligence is going to add another layer to this, is that it's my diabetes. Okay, and my diabetes is different from your diabetes. I'm not saying it's better or worse, but it's different. So why not make the treatments different, more personal? The jargon here is the heterogeneity of diabetes. But what that really means is that diabetes from a biological perspective is different between individuals, you know, the genetic makeup, the way their body functions. But when you then layer on the psychology of diabetes and then the sociology of diabetes, you're getting into opportunities for personalized interventions.
Right.
And I think that's where the technology is going to go. And your point about GLP-1 drugs, I mean, as a society, do we really want majority of humanity to be taking an injectable drug forever? Morally and ethically, I don't see that as being a great decision. And therefore, there's no doubt that a significant number of people have measurable benefits from taking these drugs. But the question is, how did we get here in the first place? Is there something that can produce the same benefits at less cost? Because you have to put cost into this. And do people really want to be taking, I mean, if you have type 1 diabetes, you have to, but in type 2 diabetes, do people really want to be taking medicines forever? And we know the answer to that is no. When you look at rates of people actually taking the prescribed medicines that they've agreed with the doctor, it's challenging for a whole variety of reasons. It's not easy. And perhaps we could say it's not actually something we want. So let's ratchet up prevention. Let's find out what lifestyle changes can be made by individuals. And it doesn't have to be the same lifestyle choice all the time. The other thing that we're finding is that there's a whole number of influences on the risk of a high A1C or the risk of diabetes. Stress is a major driver of insulin resistance and then high A1C. And then one needs to look at what are the causes of the stress for this individual. And some of them might turn out to be modifiable, but that raises all sorts of discussions about policy and healthcare planning and all that good stuff. This is a really exciting time to be involved in diabetes. And I think for your listeners, for people with diabetes, maybe who have just been diagnosed or people who had it many years, the future is actually looking far more positive than it has for a long time. But people with diabetes have a role to play in this. We need advocates, we need enthusiasts, we need digital champions. And in the United States, we're taking a look at whether we should be creating a new type of community health worker or community health scientist, people from the communities hardest hit by diabetes, and training them and paying them and giving them a career in the use of technology to support other members of their community. So this is a very, very exciting time.
David, what you've just been talking about is absolute music, I think, to both of our ears. This is really where we have a lot of interest. It would be great for listeners and for the clinicians listening to this podcast to hear a guru in diabetes technology speaking the way that you do on ancillary ways in which we can manage diabetes in addition to the technology. However, getting back to the technology and especially your characterization of the democratization of these technologies, of course, many people, as you said, can't afford it. And if they can't afford it, they often look to payers, funders, whether that's a health insurance in your context or a medical aid in the South African context for payment. We note that recently the NHS in the UK has approved a number of technologies for people with type 1 diabetes. I just want a sense from you in terms of the democratization of technologies which do carry a price. The decision makers have to take into account, does it produce a clinically significant difference? In the last 30 years I've been in diabetes, we've focused very much on the statistically significant changes. But coming into guidelines now, what are the minimal important clinical differences that we're seeing? So are we seeing those come? And then very importantly, the numbers needed to treat in terms of cost effectiveness. So maybe just for a range of technologies that you are working with, give us a sense of where that needle is in terms of payers, whether they should be funding certain technologies or not at this stage and for type 1 or type 2 diabetes.
So I actually share an office in Santa Barbara with a colleague who's an actuary, and he's an authority on contracts with payers and risk-based contracts. And I think I see his eyes roll once a week when I get a call from a company that says they've created this algorithm that will tell me which people with diabetes and patients with other diseases are not doing well. And they're saying to me, why are they trying to pitch this? Because this is of no interest to payers. Payers want to see meaningful changes, predominantly in behavior, which will lead to improvements in the metrics that they care about. And in the US, sadly, payers care about short-term metrics, right, because people keep changing their insurance plans. Mm. So they still care about A1C, they care about blood pressure, they care about smoking rates, they care about vaccination rates. So I always say to these companies, you have three questions to ask. Your technology sounds amazing, but here's the three questions. One, who is the target audience? And if they say, oh, it's everyone with diabetes, don't you know there's 500 million people going to be, I say, well, goodbye, because that is never, ever going to fly. Two, what does success look like? And if they say, well, we've had 10 gazillion downloads in the first 24 hours, I say, goodbye, because that is of no interest to the payers. And the third question is, why should someone pay for this? And that usually stumps them. So you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Michael, that we need to think about the economics of whatever is on offer here when it comes to democratization. But it's actually becoming interesting in that the world is changing. So I'm going to say something heretical now. The worst thing about continuous glucose monitors is the word continuous. This is in type 2 diabetes. Because, I mean, type 1, you need it from day to day because of the risk of insulin. That's a given, and it's marvelous. But in type 2 diabetes, do you really need to continuously wear a continuous glucose monitor? And in fact, there's some new research coming out showing that perhaps the way forward is intermittent use of technology. And so that's going to raise a question about, in type 2 diabetes and pre-diabetes, what is the most cost-effective dose of CGM? So I'm putting that phrase out there, maybe a first time for many listeners, the dose of technology. That's a concept that we need to consider and think about in the type 2 space. And the other thing is, I think maybe Stan said it earlier, that traditionally the management of type 2 diabetes is one of reaching failure points. So this fails to happen, so you get rewarded with more drugs, and then you're still failing, so you get a bigger reward with even more drugs, which are even more expensive. And of course, the pharma industry love this. You know, they're talking about therapeutic inertia. Yeah, I understand why they're interested in therapeutic inertia, because it, you know, it helps their bottom line. Mm-hmm. But what about turning this around and saying, maybe it's more cost effective to prescribe food plus a CGM rather than a prescription for GLP-1 or the addition of something else or something else, particularly in the early stages of the disease. Mm. Because pharma are never going to do cardiovascular outcome trials of lifestyle interventions. That's never going to be funded. And so what I'm saying here is that thinking about from a payer perspective upfront is really, really important. And just banging on saying, you should be covering this, does not cut much weight with payers in my experience. They like to see evidence, and the evidence must include calculations of dollars and rands. But you're right, payers, the National Health Service is a very different beast. But in the US, where there are multiple payers and they have short-term interests, and it's really important to think the way a payer thinks at the beginning. This is for anyone out there, for your listeners, who's kind of entrepreneurial and wants to build a new diabetes-related technology. They should speak to you guys at the beginning, and they should speak to people with diabetes at the beginning, but they should also speak to the peers at the beginning and get some input so that they're in the right direction, that things are scalable and sustainable. There's a graveyard full of technologies which might seem quite interesting and fun technologies, but if no one's going to pay for it, they have no future.
All right.
David, as we get to the last portion of the podcast here, share with us where AI is at this point in time, because you have this perception that all of clinical medicine is going to be revolutionized. It's happening morning, noon, and night in radiology and the like. Not so far along in South Africa just yet, but where will AI assist the person with diabetes in the next 5 to 10 year period in your mind's eye?
To be specific about artificial intelligence, where do I see it's got a future in the near term? I think there are a number of domains where it can absolutely help. And the least sexy one is that AI should be able to deal with all of the mundane, boring tasks, tedious tasks that doctors and other professionals have to do every day. If AI can arrange the appointments, check the blood results, book the next lab results, arrange the transport, and so on and so forth, that frees up time, which is the most important currency in healthcare. And that frees up time for doctors to be doctors and do doctoring. The second thing that AI should be able to do, it should be able to help to feed the electronic health record. Now, love them or hate them, I don't know anyone who loves them, but electronic health records are here to stay. And with the growth of technology, there's more and more data, and it has to be integrated into EHR, and you don't want to have multiple devices, multiple cables. And AI should be able to take care of keeping the electronic health record happy. In diabetes specifically, AI is already showing value for screening for complications, particularly eye disease. And I think that's going to just expand and expand. And then AI can also be helpful to keep people in their home. So home monitoring is going to become a big thing using artificial intelligence. And we know it's human nature that if you're at home, you're more likely to do better than if you're in hospital. Hospitals are dangerous places. There was a very famous article written by a physician called Richard Asher in the 1950s called The Dangers of Going to Bed. Particularly if you're in hospital, there's lots of bad things can happen. People would rather be in their homes, and AI can help. In diabetes, AI can also take the world's knowledge, the world's evidence, and help clinicians who may have a question about what to do next. So that's called decision support. And I think that AI might be able to be helpful there, or they'll need to be shown in clinical trials. But there's some concerns. Most importantly, one should always ask the question about an AI algorithm. Where did it come from? Who was included? Because if you build artificial intelligence algorithm and the only people contributing the data are white college-educated women, that may not generate the algorithm that's useful to be used for different populations. There's a risk of bias. And we have to be crystal clear that in the future, that representation of different communities is part of the development of artificial intelligence. And then my final optimistic view of AI, but it's also pessimistic. We know as clinicians that empathy is therapeutic. If you show you care about the person in front of you, that goes a long way to helping people live with chronic disease or get over an acute episode. Empathy is therapeutic. AI could produce real empathy, but it could also produce false empathy. And so we have to be very careful as this grows and develops that what we're seeing is real in the sense rather than made up and ineffective. And that's before we get into the whole host about other things that AI can do in a kind of political information space. We've got an election coming up in the United States this year, and I'm depressed already about the possibility of what AI is going to generate in terms of misinformation on the internet. And we have to be careful in diabetes about wading through the infodemic, as we call it, misinformation that's going to be generated. And maybe AI can help with that.
I think we've had a jam-packed podcast today, Michael. We've been absolutely blessed from experts beyond our shores, which is wonderful to aid in our communities learning and the teachings for ourselves that we offer healthcare workers who work within the diabetes community. David, I'm going to let Michael say the formal goodbyes, but absolute thank you for taking time out on this busy Thanksgiving. I was impressed that you've left the audience a sense of optimism way beyond drugs and the emerging technology that isn't immediately available in terms of what people perceive it to be, an out-of-the-box kind of quick fix tomorrow morning. But there's much to be hopeful for, that this condition, as difficult and challenging as it is, there's good news ahead. It's good news for a person such as myself who practices in diabetes medicine. And may your day of rest today be a blessed one, and towards the festive season for you and your family. And for listeners out there, if you've enjoyed the show, give us a like, give us a share. Remember, you can download this podcast on Spotify or the Apple Podcast platform. And do send your questions, thoughts, and experiences to podcast@cdediabetes.co.za.
Thank you, Stan. And thank you, David.
Pleasure.
I've been blown away by the breadth of your exploration of the intersection between technology and human beings who are living with a chronic condition.
Yeah, thank you.
Once you've got to this point in the podcast, listeners, I think you should go back to the beginning and re-listen to this very special episode. We've punted the benefits of reflection widely this year in this podcast series.
Definitely.
And I think this is an episode that you would do well to dwell on the learnings that have been given here. There's so many learnings and you might actually miss them. So I'd urge you to actually listen to this podcast episode again. David, absolutely wonderful having you on the show. And we wish you the best for Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
And any healthcare professional, if you see Dr. David Kerr on the program of any academic meeting, you should not miss it. He's a wonderful education facilitator. He comes up with the most amazing concepts, as you've heard today. Listeners, please remember our weekly polls and listener questions. We'd love to hear your take on what we ask, and we look forward to being with you for our final episode for the year next week. Over and out from us.
Thank you for joining us on Not Artificially Sweetened, where we aim to build bridges of insight and understanding between people with diabetes and the health professionals that facilitate their care. Anything we discuss is for your reflection, education, personal growth, and entertainment only. You join this podcast at your own risk, and we are not responsible for any omissions, errors, or unwanted medical outcomes. Please note the following important, specific disclaimers. For people with diabetes, the health professionals on this podcast are not your personal caregivers. Always discuss any new information with your diabetes team before acting on any aspect of it. The views and opinions discussed are those of the hosts only and do not represent those of any other entity. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you encounter in this session. Anything you learn or experience here cannot substitute for personalized, professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. For health professionals working in diabetes, always discuss any new information with your clinical team before acting on any aspect of it. You are personally accountable and liable for any choices made in a clinical setting according to your level of training and legal scope of practice. Any information or insights gained here must be used with your professional discretion and with the developing base of clinical evidence, local and organizational laws, regulations, guidelines, and protocols. Good luck with your diabetes care missions. Till next time.
And it's a wrap.
Yay!